So let's get started. People will catch up. Yeah, they'll post the audio. People now know I post the audio. I've been posting the audio. I'll keep on posting the audio. But famous birthdays today. Happy birthday to Mr. Gray. There you go. Happy birthday to Galileo, of all people, was born on February 15th. Two physics Nobel Prize winners, Charles Guillaume, who was kind of an obscure Nobel Prize, actually. But Owen Richardson is a Nobel Prize directly related to accelerator physics. Well, it's 1928, so it's kind of old, too. It's not like he built a particle accelerator. It's not like he was Lorentz or Livermore or anything. So there's how do you make our charged particles? Right? It's not like you just pick up a sack and pour them into a dumpster and have protons come out one side. Or it's not like the easiest way to get electrons is rub a balloon on your head and then stick it to the ceiling. The next easiest way is to take something and heat it up, right? So, and if you heat it up enough, you get photons coming out. If you heat it up enough, even more, you start getting electrons off of the thing. And Owen Richardson invented the first thermionic emission understanding of how electrons come off of heated metals in a true physics way and won a Nobel Prize pretty much in solid state for understanding things like what became Fermi surfaces and Fermi potentials of things. Free electrons coming out of conductor shells and jumping over that potential into freedom away from the bounded state that they are as conductive electrons in metals. So there's he's dead now, but anyway, it was his birthday. Unfortunately, it also marks the death day that I didn't write down of another very famous Nobel Prize winner. Feynman died on February 15th. So, and I remember being a graduate student when that happened, and all of us having our little moment of silence as we doodled Feynman diagrams on something. So, National Gumdrop Day, National Hippo Day—not like those two are related, even though they look kind of a similar—and Illinois Squidward Day, which is very, very confusing. Not like I'm really a SpongeBob fan, but family members are, so I had to put that in. Where are we, right? You've actually had to deal with me less than half of the course that you've experienced so far. I still haven't caught up to Tsuba and Doctors Hyde and Kraft and the number of lectures given, but you're probably already tired of me as it is. So, but more to the point, if you look forward, right, a couple of weeks from now, we're already at midterm time. And we're already at a time when I'll do some review. We're in kind of the last chapter before the midterm anyway. And the midterm will be, some things very, very similar, possibly even it's almost exactly like, since I haven't handed out solutions for it, but I will, homework problems before then, and some relatively simple lattice-y things that we're working through now. And after that is spring break. Woohoo! So March 6th and March 8th, you get a break from me anyway, whether you want it or not. And I am posting the audio stuff, right? So class lectures are up there, and I'll post today's slides as well for the next couple of classes. I'm almost positive. I started looking through the slide deck thinking, ooh, maybe we'll make it through today. And then I started thinking about what's in it. We're not going to make it through the day. It's gonna take through next class. So we're going to stay on schedule. Why I thought so was because almost a third of the deck is really very much review. Hey, how's it going? Happy Feynman Death Day. Sorry,
Oh,
I
that's
buried the
interesting.
lead. Yeah, I know. So, but Galileo was born today.
Oh,
So.
nice.
And Charles Guillaume. Woo! Charles Guillaume! We love our Charles Guillaume. So, they're all dead too. So, yeah. Galileo lives. Come on. In our hearts and minds and in an Indigo Girls song. So I'm going to review some of the Kranz-Snyder parameter stuff, some of the photo stuff. This is the guts. This is the core of what we're covering, kind of what I would call classic linear accelerator physics, and how it applies to all those other fields like solid state and periodic focusing systems with boundary conditions. You've heard me wax prosaic about that enough, at least. So I'll go into a little bit also. We've explicitly parameterized things in terms of periodic systems, slicing up that periodic focusing system in a periodic way. Well, that doesn't describe, you know, let's say I only want to describe the motion of going through half of that thing, or going from, you know, this quad through that drift, and maybe something that's not completely periodic. Can I still parameterize stuff with these betas and alphas? Yes, there is a slide on that, and kind of explaining how you get there from what we've learned so far. And then starting to talk about how we talk about particles moving through these systems, and kind of getting it's almost like a topographical map, a relationship between the picture that we have of those particles moving those ellipses, and what does it really mean when I talk about a beta function. By the end of that little bit in there, you'll be able to watch that animation of the particles moving through the quadrupoles and the drifts and the dipoles or whatever, and you'll be able to stop it at any point and draw a line and draw another line and say, oh, the beta's about this here and the alpha's about this here, from calculating some simple trig things. And then we'll go into real lattice stuff, right? What happens when I'm now breaking the periodicity in a designed way? If I've got my accelerator, which goes in a circle, I've got these dipoles that bend the beam around. Remember, you heard from this young lady over here something about dispersion. Different momenta particles are going to bend differently in those dipoles. And does this dispersion stuff also follow the same periodicity? It does. But there are going to be areas where I'm not bending the beam. Let's say I want to bend the beam around here, go straight for a while, and bend the beam again. And in that middle straight area, I don't want any of this dispersion stuff. How can I get rid of it? How can I suppress it? There are ways that you can break the photo lattice, break our focusing quadrupole, dipole, defocusing quadrupole, dipole pattern in a kind of elegant, beautiful way that takes that dispersion and lets you go straight into the exact same type of photo system where it's drifts instead of dipoles. So you can go from a bending region of focusing to a straight region of focusing without causing undue optical problems. So, and then we'll talk about other insertions, and that's, I'm sure that's next time. I'm not even sure I'll get to dispersion this time around. So a lot of this stuff we covered last time, talking about doublets, right? What's the constraint for having strong focusing if you put a box around this and bring in instead parallel rays into that box? What's the constraint or relationship between these focusing and defocusing elements necessary to end up taking those parallel rays and having them converge somewhere out there? Or having them converge somewhere back here instead and be a defocusing lens as well. There was, you know, this is kind of a general relationship because these two elements might not be the same strength as well. And then this was that true analysis of taking in real incoming paraxial rays and saying the outgoing angle has to have a different sign than the incoming position to truly be focusing, and we ended up with a real focusing condition here. We went through Hill's equation. This is now, instead of constructing, there are two. Oh my gosh, I was meaning to write this down before class, but I'll draw it now because they are really parallel ways and equivalent ways of looking at things, but it's important to connect them, right? One way of looking at accelerators is, and these transport systems, at least, is looking at things in terms of elements. That's DMF. So forget about the Q part there. And these are matrices and magnets. So this is in fact, you know, kind of a truly, you know, kind of hardware-ish way of looking at things, right? You've got a bunch of Legos in your toolbox. You're pulling out those Legos. You're sticking them together, and you can describe the motion because now you've got little matrix descriptions of exactly what happens, and in fact, you've got little matrix descriptions of what happens in the middle regarding the dynamics. So hardware, magnets, matrices, all of these things are one way of looking at the picture, which is great and fine and dandy and all of that stuff. But another way of looking at the picture is differential equations, right? So instead of matrices, I have differential equations. And instead of the fundamental description of the system looking kind of like a physical layout, what the fundamental system description of the system looks like is something that looks like you know, x double prime plus k of s x is equal to 0. And I'll put an ish out there because when we get to the dispersion, it won't be 0. But this is a differential equation, second order. It's periodic in s. And this is you know, the famous Hill's equation. And when we got, you know, what we got out of this thing, instead of matrices and differential equations, this thing leads us to things like betas. Oops, I won't. Betas and then alpha. And this alpha we found out through some differential equations that we worked through is really defined as minus the s derivative of beta divided by 2, and then there was also this gamma term that was defined as 1 plus alpha squared divided by beta. Okay, and this is a much more kind of, you know, physics-y, you know, way of looking at things. Or a much more dynamics way of looking at things. This is the way that you're taught in, you know, a classical mechanics course, right? Write down the equation of motion and solve the equation of motion. This differential equation, if you solve it, you end up with something that looks like A times the square root of this beta now times the sine of some funny thing, a betatron phase. And there is an initial betatron amplitude, too. So the really nice thing about this, and I'll point it out, is that the A and the phi naught are particle initial conditions. And in fact, you can transform, you know, you can figure out what these have to be for something like an x and an x prime 0, right? In both cases, they're two initial conditions, which is what you need for two integrals of a second order differential equation, two constants. You got constants of integration, and then. But the beta and this phase advance, which are in here and in here, which are the things that do depend on S, they give this X its S dependence, these things are functions of the lattice. And what's the lattice? Well, it's that layout of these magnets and things like that. So when we draw right down this expansion of all of these matrices in terms of L's and F's and equate it to that other matrix that has alphas and betas and things like that, what we're really doing is we're connecting back to a real solution of Hill's equation and putting both of these views of the system. This is a dynamics view of the system. This is kind of more a layout view of the system, and connecting both of those worlds. And when I describe it this way, it's pretty clear what the separation is, right? This solution this ansatz solution here, which is really how the particle, an individual particle is moving at least, has initial conditions, and then it has the effect of the potential, the effect of the dynamics of the system. And that's a very, very general statement. So we went through Hill's equation in the lecture notes, and I hand-waved my way through the ansatz, the guess of the solution, where now we know that W is really square root of beta, and we also know that beta is somehow related to the phase as well through this relationship, where the phase is just the integral as I go along the path of 1 over beta, right? ds over beta. I integrate that, and that really fundamentally is the phase, and it comes out from Hill's equation, comes out from the equations of motion, that constraint. So we have all of that, and then we cast everything in terms of this beautiful and elegant, and Todd hops up and down, fabulous description of the linear motion, at least, that ends up having this beautiful exponential form that looks a lot like Euler, right? So, and remember our solution of our equation, our ansatz solution is something like this. It's still got the A initial condition, and it's still got the phi zero initial condition. And now I can, if I assemble a matrix, remember we multiplied out something like the photo, and then we said, okay, how can I get the betas and the alphas and relate them to these matrix elements that I construct by multiplying these matrices together? The magic trick is take the trace. In the trace, these alphas all drop out, and you're left with just a cosine mu. So there is a relationship. You can get the phase advance per period of the system, per cell, from taking the trace. You can get the beta function once you know the mu by looking at this M12 component up here. And then the alphas you can figure out through all the other stuff, right? Whichever other component you want, whether it's M11 or M22. And then the gamma down here better satisfy this constraint. And that's a good double check sometimes, because if you calculate all these things out and that gamma doesn't equal those, then you've made a mistake in your math somewhere, because this matrix, by definition, is unitary. It's got unit determinant. So far, so good. This matrix is simple enough, particularly in this form, right? This M equals I cosine mu plus J sine mu. Even I can remember that. And I can't, you know, necessarily remember off the top of my head this form of J, what the J matrix is, but I know J squared has got to act like a matrix version of square root of negative 1. So, but this J matrix you just learn if you're an accelerator person, right? So this form is the periodic form. Now let's say we're, instead of going through a period of the system, we want to describe, okay, so now we've got, remember I had described my motion and I cut things apart in a way that now I have this going through one period of the system is this M, and I can call this M of S1 because now it really will depend on this S location. And if I slice the system this way instead, where now I have another half of the system here, and this is M of S2, where this location is S2, certainly these two M's are not the same, right? This M is I cosine mu plus J, oh, J depends on S, sine mu. And this is I, so this will be S1, and this is I cosine mu plus J, S2 times sine mu. Okay. So by knowing this periodicity here, well, that means that the fundamentally what it means is that, by gosh, the betas and the alphas as I go through the system are changing, because the J happens to be that alpha, beta. Whoops, is alpha minus alpha? It's alpha minus alpha, I think. Oh, alpha, beta, minus gamma, minus alpha. That's right. See, even I can't remember it, having just looked at it 30 seconds ago. But now the question is, well, what happens if I want to, I have to be able to write the matrix. This is a linear system. I have to be able to write the matrix from here to here, or from, you know, here to here. I want to write the matrix that's not this periodic thing anymore, but a piece of it, or something that's much longer that's not explicitly periodic. Well, okay, unfortunate fact of the matter is, because it's not periodic, you're not going to be able to write it down in this beautiful way anymore. And because it's not periodic, it's going to end up depending on both the beginning point and the end point. Here, it only depends on the beginning point because the betas and the alphas repeat over here. I mean, you could say it kind of depends on the betas at the beginning and the end, but they're the same things. And here, this depends on the betas and the alphas at the beginning and the end, but they're the same things. Here, if I take some piece of this, the betas and the alphas at the beginning and the end are not the same things. So I'll show you the result, because it's not too pretty. It's something that almost everybody looks up. And there is a way to go through and derive it if you want to derive it painfully. But it is just tedious, and here's a slide that shows you how to do all the derivation if you're really interested, but it's got parentheses around it, so I'm not going to talk about it any more than showing you it's there. So the general non-periodic parameterization, if I go from some point with these periodic functions to another point with these other periodic functions, is this. And it depends on the betas at the beginning and the end. It also depends on the phase advance between the two, rather unsurprisingly. Okay. And this thing looks horrible, right? I mean, it's got, you know, alphas, ones and twos and products of them and dividing by the square root of betas all over the place and stuff like that. It is, you know, quite messy and inelegant. However, even something like this, oftentimes, and I think you see it in the textbook too, this textbook is one of the first places I saw it written like this, if you just say that this is something cosine-like and this is something sine-like, and certainly that's something sine-like up in the upper right, then, well, okay, that describes the x motion. What's the next row? The next row is x prime, which is just the derivative of x with respect to s. And if, in fact, you were to derive these two top terms and then start letting one of these little s's vary and take the derivative of that with respect to s, you get the second row. It all falls out, strangely enough. So that's why in the textbook you'll see this thing written as C and S and C prime and S prime. There's just because it emphasizes that the second row is kind of like the S derivative of the first row. Out of all of this stuff, the only term that anybody ever remembers, and they memorize it because they know it and they remember it, is this upper right term. And the upper right term is because if you've got particles, if you've got the beam moving through your system, what's the thing that you can change? The thing that you can change easily is magnets. What do the magnets do? Well, okay, to zeroth order, they change the beam's direction. I change a dipole, and it steers the beam that way or the other way. So it changes x prime. Well, that's the thing that changes, you know, x prime is these two things are how the outgoing x and x prime depend on the incoming x prime. So if I change an x prime, then I'm going to multiply it by this term to get an outgoing position. Now, what do I usually measure? It's hard to measure an angle of something without measuring two positions. I can measure a position really easily, but it's really hard to measure the angle. You gotta have two positions, pretty much. So the thing that everybody remembers is change the magnet, look at the beam position. And that happens to be that term, that square root of beta 1, beta 2, sine of the phase of the angle between, sine of the phase difference between them. And if this just happens to be an optical system where you're exactly 180 degrees away, you know, go forward to this picture, and let's say I'm changing my magnet here, I'm changing my steering here, and I'm watching how the beam position moves somewhere exactly 180 degrees away. It won't be very sensitive, right? Or 360 degrees away as well. On the other hand, 90 degrees or 270 degrees away, I change the angle here a little bit, the position here is going to change quite a lot. So gives you a kind of a gut feeling for what the most important terms are out of that big, horrible, complicated formula. Anybody else that ever needs to use this looks it up or is using it in some computer program that automatically calculates it for you anyway. So that's why I emphasize down here, I blue box that upper right term. So we went through the photo last time. I did this mapping that I talked about between the matrix and hardware world and the Hill's equation beam dynamics world. So multiply out all the matrices, take the trace to get the phase advance per cell, the phase advance of one cell of this photo at least. And it gives you a constraint for stability, and then you can also find out the minimum and maximums of that photo cell. I didn't actually do the picture in here, but it's certainly worth illuminating. This Rick lattice I talked about at the end of class last time, and that picture that you can see is in fact fundamentally a photo, as is the animation that we've kind of shown from the start of class. This particle motion through a matched photo lattice that I've often shown, this picture, right? Alternating focusing, big horizontally, small vertically, then small horizontally, big vertically. This is, you know, you can see that this is a photo lattice. This is focusing adrift, defocusing adrift, and these lines are the extent, the horizontal maximum, of the beam size in either dimension, either horizontal for red or vertical for blue. So as you watch the video again, you know, look at the line and how it compares to the motion of the particle above at least. So when the red is small, the beam is also kind of small in this x extent here. It's kind of got a big angle distribution, but it's small in x. It's small, you know, physically in an actual distribution. And at the very end here, you can see now the beam is small vertically. Well, I take a projection down in the vertical plane here, and that's pretty skinny. And by gosh, in the real x and y space, yeah, that's a skinny vertical beam. And it's a kind of almost a flat, long, you know, sausage of a beam horizontally, and it's got a large x extent, which is, in fact, you know, that large thing. So these plots, remember the Ansatz solution is a square root of beta for the amplitude of oscillations. What are we plotting and talking about? The amplitude of oscillations. So this is, in fact, pretty much a picture of the square root of beta as it moves through the system. What was that picture from the Rick design book that was shown last time and just flashed again now? It was, you know, plotting that beta function. Now, not the square root of it, because we know to take the square root of in our heads for the real beam size at least. But this alternating back and forth looks just like that little simulation, looks just like the dynamics that I showed you, where the beam alternates back and forth horizontally and vertically. Okay, so far so good. So now that a lot of that was review, but now we're going to, I showed you one trick, one magic trick, which was how do I figure out how to propagate particles from one beta and alpha location to another beta and alpha location. How do I write down my matrix? And remember, my matrix is truly the thing that if I multiply this by x and x prime going in, I got the x and x prime coming out. Okay? Well, instead of talking about the x's and x primes and the matrix itself, I can also ask, in terms of these matrix elements, or the betas and the alphas and the phase advances, how would I talk about the transformation of beta and alpha from one location to another? They're changing in S, so how can I propagate my Courant-Snyder parameters from one location to another if I know the matrix between those two locations? And that's what this next step is, and that's the slide. Okay, so this slide here, if I have the Courant-Snyder parameters at one location, and then I know, okay, I've multiplied all my matrices together, so I know this is the layout of all of the magnets getting from here to there. What are the beta and the alpha at the other end? I don't want to have to. It's not a periodic system. I don't know the betas and the alphas at the end, so I can't use this non-periodic transport matrix. I, in fact, have to kind of do the other thing around. I know the matrix, and I want to pull out the betas and the alphas and the new phase. If you do it just brute force from this thing, your eyes are going to fall out of your head. You're going to break Mathematica. It's horribly hard, okay? And you thought this was tedious. Hoo boy, that's, you know, many, many pages of stupid tedious. But there's a convenient trick. There's a miracle trick that puts it all on one slide. So here is a periodic system, and here's an S1 and an S2. And I can, in fact, say, okay, let's write this down, this periodic system, going around from S1 to S1 in terms of my magic expansion. And that's a perfectly good parameterization. That's perfectly legal because it's periodic. If I go now, what I can do is I can talk about, okay, transforming, let's see. So if, getting to this step is a little bit of a trick. I'll do it for you because it is. It is a cute and convenient trick, but it is it makes sense, and it's not obvious if you just look at this slide. So I'll work through it real quick. Whoops, not that one, that one. I always forget these things. So here's S1 and S2. Okay? And I have now So in going from M of S1 to S1 plus C, and going around the entire system again, I can write that thing in terms of an I cosine mu plus J of S1 sine mu. Right? And remember, our J matrix happens to be... it happens to be alpha... beta minus gamma minus alpha. I remembered it this time. Fool me once, shame on me. So one alternative to going from S1 to S2, okay, if a particle is going from S1 to S2, at least, let's see. Right. So going from S1 to S2, I can write it down two clever ways. I can write it down as M going from S1 to S2, right? I can also write it down as going from, I should have remembered this trick before class, because I always get a little bit tangled on this. It's a neat trick when you think of it, but you have to think of it to remember the trick. So one way to write it is that way. Another way to write it is going around all the way. Let's see. Okay, let me try and rederive it from the result instead, because it's silly to go from it forward. The result I'm trying to get, at least, is that J of S2 is equal to M going from S1 to S2 times J of S1 times the inverse going from S1 to S2. Okay. So another way of looking at this is if I multiply the move that inverse over, instead I have a J of S2, M going from S1 to S2 is equal to M from S1 to S2, J of S1. Okay. I can generally write down any full turn revolution matrix in terms of an I and a J. The key thing about the trick, at least, is that the I's commute with these M's and these J's. So it turns out that there are I terms here that cancel on both sides. So for example, I can multiply both of these sides by sine mu. And I can add to both of these sides an I cosine mu. And in fact, I want to add to both of those sides an I cosine mu, M of S1 to S2. Okay. So what I've got here, this is... is that right? The I cosine mu plus J2 sine mu. This entire thing in here looks like M from S, you know, kind of like an S2 going from S2 to S2 plus C, right? That I cosine mu plus J2 sine mu is this thing, times M of S1 plus S2. Over here, I also have an I cosine mu, M of S1 plus S2. Now on the, plus J of S1 times M1. So this looks like M of S1 plus S2. Times M going from S1 to S1 plus C. I'll figure it out after. I'll figure it out and write it up in the notes. This is, I don't want to take too long burdening through it. It is much, much shorter than trying to do it the very, very long way. Absolutely. But what you get, anyway, what you get by some magic of the I's dropping out and commuting with these M's, by looking at two different ways of going around this loop from S1 to S2, either going from S1 to S2 straight away, or going from S1 all the way around to S2 and then coming back again at least, is you end up getting that extra inverse in there, and you end up getting a nice little relationship that only involves the matrix going from S1 to S2, which you said you know, and now this J of the original, which is the original betas and alphas, because those are in the J, and now I've got the new betas and alphas over in this J. So if you expand all of that stuff out, multiply things out, match these terms together, you can write down kind of a cool little interesting and symmetric matrix in terms of these matrix elements that you know going from one location to the other. And those multiply the original Courant-Snyder parameters and give you the new Courant-Snyder parameters at the end. And you can find out that, in fact, let's say that what I'm doing is I'm going all the way around one period of the system. Well, then this better, these betas better be periodic, and these betas and alphas and all those things better be equal. And if I take any true revolution matrix that follows that I cosine mu plus J sine mu, you know, form, and put it in here, all of this stuff drops out, and I do, in fact, get the betas and the alphas and the gammas being equal for the periodic system, and also for, you know, M's being things like the identity matrix as well. So this matrix, honestly, I can say I'm teaching you relevant stuff that accelerator physicists use every day, because I used this equation earlier today when I was looking at the how to change some magnets for Hall D tuning in at CBAF and figuring out exactly how to set things up. Okay. So sorry about the divergence about the trick. I thought I could remember the trick on the fly, but I'll have to make a note to rederive the trick. So this is an animation that is very similar to what we had before, but now you can see there are dipoles in here as well, these long flat guys, and that the motion looks very, very similar to how it was before, except in going through the dipoles, you can see there's a little bit of particle motion in this phase space. They don't quite look completely like the drifts. They kind of rotate around a little bit. But certainly as I go through these quadrupoles, the particles shear vertically. And as I go through the dipoles, the particles, for the most part, look like they shear horizontally, right? The stuff on top moves to the right. The stuff on bottom moves to the left. And as I go through the quadrupole, depending on which sign the quadrupole is, particles on the left side go up and the particles on the right side go down, or vice versa. And you can see also that this now is not a perfectly periodic system anymore. I didn't put in a perfect beam distribution of particles that was exactly matched to the period of the system. So you can see that there's a difference. There's a difference between the description of the beam, and this description is literally derived from moving a bunch of particles through these magnets, multiplying them, you know, by the magnet matrices, and looking at the maximum of that distribution over time, and what the ideal system is, which you can derive from the periodic boundary conditions, right? So I have not matched the periodic boundary conditions here, and you can see that things look messier. This brings us to probably the greatest source of confusion among all first-year accelerator physicists at all. And that is, should have told you at the very beginning, there are really kind of two sets of betas and alphas. There's betas and alphas that we talk about when we're talking about the periodic focusing system and solutions for the periodic constraints, the lattice, the magnets, the layout of the optics. Those are true Courant-Snyder parameters. But Yeah, there's also this kind of beta-like thing, which is the large, the amplitude of the particle beam moving through the system. And if this were in fact set up to follow the periodic boundary conditions, those two would be the same. And you would say, oh, that's beta. And you wouldn't have to say that's beta the beam or that's beta the lattice. Okay. But different people talk about betas of the beam, and different people talk about betas of the lattice. And sometimes, unless the context is very clear, it is very easy to get confused to the point where you misunderstand and you think it's the other one. So let's now talk about this ellipse. And this ellipse, now what I'm talking about is I'm talking about the betas when I show you and I write this down. In terms of this parameterization, this is not the betas of the lattice anymore. This is the betas of a distribution of particles, which are the beam. Okay? And yes, in a perfect world, they're the same thing if the beam is perfectly matched to the lattice. So in fact, there is an invariant here, it's called. So this picture, there's quite a I drew this ellipse, and as you watch individual particles, those individual particles kind of move around in circle-y type things, but they don't they shift through this ellipse. They certainly don't rotate around in the space at exactly the same rate that the ellipse does, right? So, and as I go through, if I go through my periodic system, and I go through one period, then 2 periods, then 3 periods. Remember, what you're going to see is you're going to see the same, in principle, the same ellipse again, but the particles will be redistributed around the ellipse in a different way. So this black particle goes over here in one revolution, over here in 2 revolutions, over here in 3 revolutions, or 3 periods through the system, just like that. Long wavelength, right? The picture of this. The particle doesn't return to its original point in the ellipse, until or close to that, until way, way out here somewhere, through many periods of the actual focusing channel or the focusing system. So, but what does stay the same? Well, what does stay the same is as the particle moves around, it really does trace an ellipse in phase space. And that ellipse in phase space has an area, and it's related to this initial condition, kind of an amplitude of the particle's oscillation. You could do a transformation, you could put this in true polar coordinates and make this into a circle, and this would be a real radius, and this would be a real phase. That's perfectly fair game. But because it's an ellipse and a complicated thing, there's a cross term in the middle that's kind of complicated. But the parameterization of this ellipse is this. So think of this, think of a particle moving on an ellipse, and this is the equation of the ellipse. It's a second order equation, an x and x prime. Think of it like a parametric form of an ellipse, where these alphas and betas and gammas are constant for this particular location in the periodic focusing system. So if I keep on coming back to that, particles move around that ellipse at least. So in our matrices, just then look like scaled rotations in this phase space, right? I keep on going around the ellipse, and all I do is gain phase in the ellipse, but I didn't change my amplitude at all. This invariant, this kind of magic area, this, and if you write this out, it does in fact end up being like the minor and major axes multiplied by each other. It really does end up being like an area, is called the Courant-Snyder invariant. It was something just like Courant-Snyder parameters. It was something observed even in the very very initial paper that's on the website. So the area of this ellipse now, very, very commonly, people put a pi in there as well because it's a circle or it's an ellipse. The area is pi times the product of the two, the semi-major and semi-minor axes again. But generally, I mean, I could draw a similar ellipse to this, right? I could draw an ellipse in here, and particles on that ellipse stay on that smaller ellipse. I could draw a larger ellipse out here, and particles on that larger ellipse stay on that larger ellipse. If I keep on snapshotting it exactly at the same phase in my periodic system every time, at the same periodicity, at the same, or in a ring, you know, let's say particles are going around a ring accelerator, and I've got one monitor just measuring particle positions as they go around the system. Of course, that's periodic in the lattice, the arrangement of the magnets, but the particles ain't coming back to the same position every single time. I take that and I plot them, and they're going to act like, you know, simple harmonic oscillators in this funny little phase space here. So the area of this thing is important, because the bigger this area is, or the smaller this area is, the bigger or smaller your beam is in kind of this phase space, and the bigger or smaller the maximum amplitude of this beam is. If I wait a little while until this ellipse is practically horizontal, that's my maximum beam size. If I wait a little while until that ellipse is almost vertical, that's my minimum beam size. So what is the average beam size, or what is the RMS of this distribution of particles? Well, it turns out it's related to the amplitude of oscillations. It must be related to square root of beta. And the thing that multiplies that is this scaling factor, this area called the emittance. So this RMS area of this thing is directly related to the beam size through this relationship. The RMS beam size is the square root of some intrinsic quality about the size of that particles, or the size of the average of this many particles in the beam, the ellipse that circumscribes those, and then some quantity, that beta function as well. I think I have, yes, this is that kind of reference guide that I was mentioning earlier. So if I put a screen up, right, take my distribution here, right, and I put a screen up, and I see that's how big the beam is. So I've got some macroscopic distribution of the beam, and I know it's big horizontally and it's small vertically. And if I were to measure the beam's angles, I could even plot these phase spaces. I could get an idea of the distribution of the particles in x and x prime and y prime. And now I say, okay, what's the beam's emittance? What are the beam's beta functions? There are relationships between all of those. If I take the maximum, kind of the RMS beam size here, remember it was the square root of the emittance times the beta function. And that curly W is what the book uses for emittance, for this Courant-Snyder invariant. If I look at the intersection of this ellipse with the positive x-axis, it relates that emittance to the gamma, the 1 plus alpha squared over beta thing. And there are also some relationships between those as well in the vertical axis, in the intersections of the vertical axis. This thing has length units. That's why it's the most useful. It really relates to the beam size. This y2 up here is kind of like the beam divergence, right? It's how big the beam is in angle space instead of in position space. And that's why if you figure out the units of this thing, they're unitless, just like this thing is unitless. It's radians or milliradians. The other thing that you can observe from all of these reference points, everything scales with square root of that invariant. Bigger ellipse, smaller ellipse, okay, it scales back and forth like that. But that invariant is the size of the ellipse, and then the local beta function and gammas, which include the alphas at least, are related to these locations. You can also see that there is at both, I go back to this picture here. At this picture, remember this the rate of change of this maximum amplitude here is like the square root of the beta function, right? And the alpha is like the derivative of that. So at this location, I can already say, by gosh, the beta is hitting a maximum. The beam size is horizontally a maximum, so alpha is zero. And also over here, the beam size is hitting a minimum, alpha is zero. So in the middle of the quadrupoles, alpha is zero, right? The beam size turns over. Either it's hit a minimum or it's hit a maximum, but it's got a local slope of zero at least. And so that conveniently, you know, makes you feel better about the picture, because now in the middle of a quadrupole, this maximum thing is the square root of the emittance, that y2 is the square root of the emittance times gamma. Well, gamma was 1 plus alpha squared over beta. Alpha is 0, so it's like 1 over beta. So the divergence of the beam, just at a maximum or a minimum, the size of the beam goes like the square root of beta. The divergence of the beam goes like 1 over square root of beta. So just like you would expect, you know, they trade it, the beta function trades off, right? It's the divergence is trading off against the beam size and vice versa.
So what is that sort of equation? Is it the same for the yy prime too?
It's the same for the yy prime as well. Yeah. I mean, they oscillate back and forth. Certainly the betas are different. There's a beta x and a beta y, yeah, and an alpha x and an alpha y. But
the
yes, there's.
The relationship is the same, right?
Huh?
This format is the same.
But these formulas are the same. You can pick up the Handbook of Accelerator Physics, and this picture and these formulas are in there, pretty much, you know, probably with epsilons instead of w's, but it's the same thing. So one more thing. Emittance is in... I'll connect it to optics for a second, just general optics, because it is important. Before I had drawn this picture of, you know, this source of our beam going into our optical system and trying to talk about taking this diverging beam that's coming into our system and keeping it focused as we got it through, you know, our various magnets going through some experimental hall over to some happy experimenter over here at least. The emittance equals kind of like the beam area in phase space. And I just, I think I added one too many M's in there. And I had just talked about it being conserved, right? As you look in our various simulations, the area of that ellipse as it tumbles through this space doesn't change at all. This is directly related to Liouville that we talked about before as well, and the way these things work. It turns out that this statement, and I put little quotes around it at least, that this is kind of a lie, honestly. And that's because there is a way that area changes in phase space, and that is this phase space is written, remember, as x and x prime. And I've got my particles in here, and they're moving around in ellipses, and they're moving around in these gorgeous ellipses. This x prime, remember, is defined as p sub x over the total momentum, right? Well, okay, so that's fine. As long as the total momentum is constant, then this entire thing works. But if I start putting my particles through something that changes their energy through an RF cavity, through something that actually does accelerate, that does change their total momentum or total energy at least, this vertical axis kind of gets rescaled because I'm changing the entire definition of what is being plotted up there. Let's say, you know, if I accelerate the particles to infinite momentum, this thing gets squashed down to nothing. And of course, by definition, then the emittance, that area, is going to be close to zero. It's going to be almost nothing, right? So instead of talking about just this area in regular old phase space, what we accelerator physicists do is we pull a little bit of a fast one. We say, well, okay, if you're talking about just magnets, that's fine, because it's just magnets, you're not going to change the total momentum. But if you're going through acceleration systems, at least, and this rescaling of the vertical axis does take place, I know how that scaling takes place. It's a scaling of momentum. And momentum from relativity is beta gamma mc. So if beta and gamma are the things they're changing, right? Rest mass doesn't change. C, I hope, doesn't change. So I've got only beta and gamma. So if I were to add back in that beta and gamma for the particles and rescale everything back, now I can have an emittance that in fact doesn't change anymore, even when things are accelerated. But it's a different emittance. It's not just the area in this phase space, it's the area in this phase space with an extra term thrown in related to the particles' relativistic parameters or the beam's relativistic parameters at the time, the beta and the gamma. Okay. So this effect, as you accelerate, and this thing shrinks and shrinks, this area in the phase space shrinks and shrinks, the term there technically is called adiabatic damping. You can see that in some of the literature. It really looks like a shrinkage of the phase space. It really looks like Liouville is, you know, a lie, and all of a sudden 18th century mathematicians didn't know what they were talking about. They did. It's just use the proper term. Use the normalized emittance instead. And it is very, very easy to get caught up between this emittance and that emittance if you're talking to a person who's cavalier about it and does not say whether it's normalized emittance or unnormalized emittance. For high energy machines, these things are usually big, right? Beta is usually close to one and gamma can be many thousands. So by just looking at their numbers, like I know at CBAF, typical emittances, this typical emittance here is something like 10 to the minus ninth, and the typical normalized emittance is more like 10 to the minus sixth. And so if I see a number that says, oh, the emittance was 5, 10 to the minus six today, oh my God, I know they're talking about a normalized emittance and not a geometric emittance, it's called, an unnormalized emittance. So stuff like that. So let's go into rings and tunes real quick, and then we'll set up for stability in the next lecture and dispersion. Which will take up most of the next lecture, at least. So I have my periodic focusing systems. Well, let's talk about rings. And you had asked earlier, at least, you had mentioned something about tunes. Okay, tunes are just the betatron phase advance in a ring, but you normalize it to the total angle that you go around the ring, which is 2 pi. Remember I told you, do everything in normalized units if you can help it? Well, we even get so far as to do everything in normalized units, even with angles. So I go around 2 pi in my circular accelerator, and I say, okay, what's my betatron phase advance for going around 2 pi of my normalized accelerator? And let's call that something magic. That's a tune, okay? So instead of the mu now, now it's the mu divided by 2 pi. It's normalized truly for going around an accelerator. So you can see here, this picture, there are, think of the tunes as the number of oscillations or the number of wavelengths as you go around, go through a periodic system. So here there are 6, and then there is a third oscillation. Or here there's a kind of a funny little vertical oscillation. with 7.5, because you're almost exactly 180 degrees out there. Turns out that in these types of systems and these types of accelerators, if the tune is an integer, so if the thing is kind of looks like a standing wave where you come exactly back to where you were, dogs and cats live together, right? Horrible things happen. The machine falls apart, beam falls out of the machine, and nothing works anymore. Because all of a sudden, because it's a standing wave, anything that excites that standing wave will kind of resonate on itself. You're exactly in resonance. And it will grow and grow and grow and grow until the beam hits the wall and then you're done. And then the government comes and shuts you down and takes you to that funny little place I won't talk about. So so higher tunes imply... Yeah, exactly. We love our jackets. So higher tunes means more focusing, right? Because there's more wavelengths. So you usually have a lot more quadruples if you have a higher tune of an accelerator. The accelerator I worked at in New York, there were about 28 or 29 oscillations every time you went around the circumference, which just happened to be 3,833.845 meters. Not like I memorized the damn thing, but okay. I worked there for 17 years. 3,800 meters, and so 3,800 meters in the tune of 29, so the average, you know, wavelength of oscillations was 130 meters or something like that. And like I said, if you ever end up in a place where these tunes are some multiple of an integer, or multiplying a tune ends up exactly on an integer in some funny way, you do end up with instabilities, these resonant instabilities. We'll talk about that after the midterm.
Is it just the k, or even an m independently produce integer is cause problem?
So this is a general form. If these m's and n's and k's get high, then it's less of a problem, it turns out. But it is any k in the sense that q equals 1 is bad, q equals 1/2 is bad, q equals 1/3 and 2/3 is not as bad, but it's still bad. Q equals 327 over 324, well, that one's okay, because they're big numbers instead of small numbers, okay? And because there's, you know, you don't end up coming exactly back to where you were until 324 times back around. On the other hand, q equals 1/2, you're here, you're back here again exactly. And anything that has a periodicity of 2 in the system, like your quadruples, tends to blow you out of the accelerator. So you can write down that kind of Euler-ish form. Remember I cosine mu plus j sine mu? Now, okay, well, those mu's for these systems, what's mu? It's the phase advance of one turn around the accelerator, which is 2 pi times q. So that's your little introduction to synchrotron tunes. We will go more into nonlinear dynamics maybe after the midterm and stuff like that. Next time I'll go into stability diagrams and dispersion and insertions, and we will go from there. So I'll see you guys next Tuesday, and we'll talk a little bit about what the plans are for the midterm, too. And in the meantime, have a good weekend and enjoy. Go see where is the concert? Is it anywhere nearby?
The Sandler Center.
So there you go. So.